Thank you. Good morning. It's both a pleasure and a privilege this morning to introduce the co-chairman of this conference, appropriately enough to keynote day two, in which its focus shifts from the executive branch, where it resided most of yesterday, to at least a morning's worth of close attention to Capitol Hill, with panels on congressional control of the administration of government, and on the appropriation power and necessary and proper clause. The details of Senator Charles Robb's distinguished career need no repetition at this time by me. Chuck is, among other things, a living bridge between the executive and legislative functions in this country, having served as the most successful governor in modern Virginia history after a stint as lieutenant governor before coming to the U.S. Senate. Chuck asked me earlier this morning whether he knew anybody here, and I said that I could only speak to my dinner table experience last night with Lloyd Cutler to my left and Griffin Bell to my right, geographically speaking, of course. Were there any Republicans in the room, Chuck wanted to know, concerned lest this be seen as anything but a bipartisan talk for him. And I told him that it was my impression that there were one or two Republicans in the room as well. Senator Robb is a special person and political leader to me, not simply because both in war and peace he has embodied the highest standards of civic virtue for Americans, nor alone because of his exemplary record as governor, but for one other reason. He is a political leader committed within his party to asserting the fundamental concerns of the American people, among which, to cite a trio which I seem to recall reading somewhere in the past day, he would surely count those of individual liberty, traditional values, and the rule of law. Even before becoming a senator, Charles Robb had helped to organize the Democratic Leadership Council to confront extremist demagoguery within his party and to assert its mainstream commitments. Now in the Senate, he represents the type of political figure who, underlying the argument last evening, one could hear both Lloyd Cutler and Richard Epstein calling for. Someone capable of mobilizing a party sufficiently adept at conducting sound and coherent public policies whether or not the government was unified, in short, a party leader in Cutler's view, while at the same time strong and confident enough to take principled stands on behalf of those policies, whatever political fashion might otherwise dictate. Someone surely that Professor Epstein was suggesting was in short supply in this town type of person. Chuck will speak this morning, quoting him, on random constitutional thoughts with some particular belly aching about the budget process. All right. And without further comment, I present to you the co-chairman of this conference, Senator Charles S. Robb of Virginia.
Thank you, Alan. I did not mean to be taken literally when he asked me what is the topic or what is the title that you have given to your remarks. And I said, well, I hadn't really thought about it. Why don't we call it such and such? And you heard a very literal translation, perhaps in keeping with certain principles that this organization might find near and dear of what I said to him this morning. In any event, I'm pleased to be able to join you. I appreciate the invitation to serve along with a friend and former colleague in your current Attorney General, Dick Thornburgh, as a co-chair of the conference, and to, in that capacity, have an opportunity to start things off this morning. I think the last time that Dick and I were together, and we've had a number of experiences together, but the last time, I guess, was when we were both in the latter stages of our gubernatorial terms and asked to represent our respective parties at the 100th anniversary of the Gridiron Club, and they had a dinner up in Philadelphia, and we each had an opportunity to express a few thoughts then. It occurs to me now, as I think about times that he and I spent together, that one of the previous times was going behind the Berlin Wall, the two of us going through Checkpoint Charlie at a rather different, in a different environment, when we were over at an Aspen Institute conference at Berlin, discussing some things with some of the individual lender leaders there. But I'm in any event pleased to join him. You've had a very interesting program. Frankly, Dennis, to you and all of the other members of the Federal Society, I must tell you that I am impressed by the caliber and the distinction of those you have been able to attract to this particular conference. Most conferences end up getting one or two people that have a relatively high visibility, and another group of scholars and people who provide a great deal of substance but are not as individually well known. You have quite a remarkable collection of folks that will come and share a Friday and a Saturday with you, and I commend you for that success. In truth, I might have talked to you this morning about another system that is in the process of undergoing some change. It's not exactly a federal system yet, but it is approaching it in some respects. I have just come back from 4 days as a guest of the European Community. I spent a day each in Brussels, in Luxembourg, and in Strasbourg. In Brussels, I had an opportunity to spend most of my time with members of the Commission, which are in many respects the executive branch of that limited government. I then went on to Luxembourg and spent a day with the court, and was frankly very impressed. I really hadn't taken that much time to think about the court activities, but I spent some time with the chief judge of their court, who is called president of their court, and a number of judges as well as advocates general, and recognized a functioning court system that has real clout in terms of what it does and its ability to provide some reaffirmation of the process that the European Community is going through. Then I spent the last day with the European Parliament. The only group I didn't spend time with in any specific amount of time is the Council of Ministers, who are more ad hoc and meet depending upon the particular topic. Different ministers represent the respective nations in that particular process. But it's interesting to observe the process of the 12 current members of the European Community trying to decide how to give up certain amounts of their national sovereignty and fit it into some sort of a, at least the equivalent of a federal structure. And if I hadn't been completely overtaken by jet lag, I would try to give you some sense of some of my impressions from that particular meeting, because it's interesting, and obviously the relationship that the community is going to have with the United States, particularly in view of the developments that have taken place in Eastern Europe and the impact those changes are going to have not only on the community, but on most of the rest of the world, are fascinating at this particular time. But nonetheless, I've been asked to begin the day for what is going to be an examination, I guess, of the congressional role in this federal process and the judicial role, although they're inextricably intertwined in ways that not everyone would approve of, but nonetheless, you can't escape noting some overlap, and indeed, I guess that's been a large part of the focus. I regret that I'm not going to be able to remain for the rest of today's program, but I hope that you're going to publish some sort of proceedings, because the topic that you address is one that's of interest. And again, one for the last 4 days that I have been pursuing. I've been asking the pointed questions of what happens when push comes to shove in resolving a particular dispute between the Commission and the Parliament and the Council of Ministers, and what is the role in that dispute resolution of the judiciary or the court. So it is perhaps appropriate. In any event, in just a few days, the 101st Congress begins its second session. And I suppose that does make it an appropriate time to pause and reflect on the nature of shared responsibility between the Congress and the presidency, to take the temperature of the body politic as Congress and the president continue in this third century of sharing power. Montesquieu's notion of a tripartite body sharing power over the government, but not over each other, was really a fundamental philosophical precept of our Constitution. John Jay's simple response to General Washington's entreaty to the leaders of the time to describe the best post-revolutionary government succinctly and accurately really describes today's government. Let Congress legislate, let others execute, let others judge. The framers were nearly unanimous in believing that a lack of separation of powers was one of the primary disadvantages of the Articles of Confederation. Our own Thomas Jefferson, and forgive me for parochial references to Mr. Jefferson, but as most of you know, we believe that he is still alive and well and just temporarily absent from our Commonwealth. Mr. Jefferson, ever mistrustful of an executive that could manipulate or influence the judiciary, found the equilibrium of the three great powers the most appealing aspect of the new Constitution. His first comment upon reading the document while at his post in France was, quote, "I much like the organization of the government into legislative, judiciary, and executive." Mr. Jefferson's chief objection to the new Constitution was that the executive, because he could at that point be reelected for life, was perhaps too powerful. The president, he observed to Adams, seems a bad addition of a Polish king. Without some check on the number of terms he could serve, the president would, Mr. Jefferson feared, become a monarch. History proved that even the sage of Monticello could be wrong, although indeed we did a little earlier in this century decide to provide a limitation on those terms. And indeed, power has ebbed and flowed between the two bodies over the last 200 years as the tenor of the times has changed. Just 20 years after Abraham Lincoln exercised nearly supreme power in the White House, a relatively young Woodrow Wilson would write that, quote, "Our present form of government is simply a scheme of congressional supremacy." Of course, a quarter century later, Wilson himself led America into greater participation in international affairs. The economic and political upheavals of the 30s and 40s made many observers believe that Congress had become superfluous. But in 1960, the pendulum had swung so far in the opposite direction that some of those same pundits complained that not only was Congress dominant in national affairs, a single committee chairman, Howard Worth Smith of Virginia, chairman of the Rules Committee, was controlling the direction of the nation. Over the last decade, however, this natural ebb and flow has seemed to stall. In my view, this is partially because of a reaction to perceived presidential excesses in the conduct of the Vietnam War and in the Watergate scandal, and partially because neither political party has been able to do much to loosen the stranglehold the other party seems to have on a particular branch of government. Victory by the same party in five of the last six presidential elections has helped to institutionalize a form of stasis in our government that reflects an equilibrium in American politics that was simply unpredictable when the founders met in Philadelphia. And it's becoming abundantly clear that divided government, where the Democrats control the Congress and the Republicans the presidency, can be, in some instances, a formula for timid, passive, and in some cases, even purposeless governance. Under divided government, ideological conflicts frequently turn into institutional confrontations between a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. All too often, the result is governmental paralysis. This institutional stalemate leads to political complacency and escapism. Both sides concentrate on preserving their political domains rather than risking alienating anyone by daring to grapple with a thorny issue. Too often, long-term planning becomes deciding how to get from one public opinion poll to the next. And so we dissipate our political energies debating peripheral issues. In the last session, we spent a week helping the National Endowment for the Arts set artistic standards, and nearly a week each on two personnel matters involving the impeachment of federal judges. But when it came to really important issues, we simply lacked the will to even confront them. Instead, there has developed almost an inverse relationship between the emotional intensity of our political discourse and its relevance to what our nation really needs. In a reflection of our institutional paralysis, symbolic issues like flag burning too often take precedence over the truly critical issues that this government faces. We have no mechanism to ensure that the President and Congress are at least as accountable when doing the people's business as we insist they are in their personal lives. Fiscal irresponsibility is, in my opinion, a serious breach of public trust. I'd like to make it an impeachable offense, were it not for the fact that, as Mr. Jefferson observes, that impeachment is not even a scarecrow. Unfettered by accountability, we are free to display enormous ingenuity, devising stratagems to defer decisions on the really important issues of our time. Last year, for example, rather than attempting to deal with our budget deficit, in an astonishing display of head-in-the-sandism, we patched together a budget, the principal feature of which was to make things worse in the upcoming year. Then the President and the congressional leadership went out into the White House Rose Garden and congratulated themselves on a job well done. Later in the year, literally in the 11th hour, Congress agreed to a debt limit extension, increasing the national debt to over $3.1 trillion. I would submit to you that our fiscal problems are at once a symptom and a cause of America's ideological paralysis. A massive national debt, well over half of which was incurred in the last decade, combined with continued huge deficits to preclude government spending as a solution to any problem. So we have a government that is unable to spend and unwilling to cut spending. Couple that with the widespread lack of public confidence in government's ability to deal with problems caused at least in part by HUD and SNL scandals, and it is little wonder that America seems adrift in a sea of change. The root cause of our institutional paralysis, I would suggest to you, is not so much a lack of political will, but a lack of a set of relevant national priorities that reflect the needs and realities of a new era. Of course, we can't establish priorities for the future unless we understand where we are in the world today. Economic policies forged in the Depression, a map of the world drawn at Yalta, and social and cultural patterns framed by the schisms of the 60s are, I would submit, relatively poor tools to attack challenges facing America domestically as well as internationally as the 21st century dawns. Nor can we continue defining progress in terms of marginal adjustments to the status quo. It seems to me that we are doomed if we accept the premise that the government of the 21st century will simply be a linear extension of the government of today. I believe that we need to wipe the slate clean, to ask and answer the question, why do we as a government exist? We should ask ourselves, what should tomorrow's government do? What should it look like? And we've got to be ready to tell the American people how we get from what we have, which in my opinion is in many instances woefully inadequate, to where we want to be. So I would suggest beginning this exercise by rejecting the assumption that holds us in thrall, that all existing programs and policies are sacrosanct. Then, with a clean slate in front of us, we can become the architects of a fundamental redirection of national priorities. Virginia's constitution is not too dissimilar to our nation's. And as a former governor, I know that the principal responsibility of the chief executive, over and beyond the execution of the laws, is to provide that kind of ideological and moral leadership. But if the executive branch won't lead, the legislative branch then has the opportunity to break the current political impasse. In order for that to come about, Congress would have to recognize that it's not enough to offer a piecemeal patchwork of programs to the American people. It seems to me that America needs an all-encompassing blueprint for tomorrow. We've got to define for the American people a moral framework or public philosophy that our fundamental principles, our goals, and if you will excuse an overused expression, our vision for tomorrow will fit into. I would suggest that the means to this fundamental redirection of our policy may well be the budget. There are two reasons. First, the budget is or should be nothing more than an annual restatement of our national priorities. National spending ought, with some few exceptions, to reflect the needs of the day. The second reason to start re-examining our priorities in the budget framework is simpler. Unless we get our budget under control, little else that we can do can really have much meaning. Already, our options are severely limited. A few more years of out-of-control spending, and we won't have any options left. It is my hope and belief that the not-too-distant future will find both the President and the Congress considering a budget which reflects our national needs and desires, rather than simply an extension of a pattern of programs and promises which may or may not even be relevant today. Then, armed with an understanding of where we are and a sense of where we want to be tomorrow, we can begin to deal with issues like how we restore a sense of fiscal sanity to Washington, or rebuild America's productive capacity, or rescue children living in poverty, or reassure ourselves of clean air and water, or solve the healthcare crisis, or capitalize on the opportunities presented by the world's turn to democracies and free markets. The genius of Madison and Hamilton was, in the often quoted phrase, the creation of a machine that goes by itself. Thomas Macaulay wrote of the Constitution that it was all sail and no anchor. The winds which propel such a machine are the hopes, the needs, and the aspirations of the people at a particular time in our history. Today, we are becalmed by our ideological paralysis. Once we identify today's priorities, the ideological calm in which we find ourselves as the 1990s begin, I believe, will be largely lifted, and the Constitution will again operate to, as Mr. Jefferson observed to Mr. Adams, quote, render our fellow citizens the happiest and the securest on whom the sun has ever shone. Well, that completes my introduction for today. A few random thoughts, and as Alan so accurately, regrettably quoted me, and bellyaching about the budget, to get your juices flowing just a bit this morning, I appreciate again the opportunity to share a few thoughts with you. I appreciate the fact that you have come together to discuss what is an enormously important topic, although one that doesn't always command the headlines because it doesn't have some of the appeal that many other contemporary events have and tend to take our attention and our focus, but one which nonetheless has an enormous role in determining exactly how it is we do whatever it is we're expected to do here in Washington, and I look forward to reading about the conclusions reached by this particular conference and to perhaps participating with you at some future time, but I thank you.